Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40. One of our sons is facing over this Christmas holiday. I hope his teacher's not didn't show up this morning. She's not here. She's good. Okay, then I can tell you. One of our sons is facing his famous fourth grade mission project. You know, those of you whose kids are in the California school system, any school, anywhere, fourth grade is usually the year when they make you do those. Remember, you build sugar cubes and remember all that? Okay. And so one of our children is facing that. We're going to start tomorrow. We've got a week to finish this thing. We're going to be putting together a model of the typical California mission. We'll be buying supplies. We've already got most of them. We'll be measuring things. We'll be cutting materials. We'll be gluing and painting and stuff. We're going to make a creation. We're going to make a work of art. Did that come across like proud or something? Yeah, I don't know. Wait till you see what it's going to look like. We're much larger than the people that will populate our little mission. They're just going to be little toys and all, but we're quite a bit larger than them. If you were to zoom down into their world and take a look at one of their inches, it'd be quite small. What might be a great distance to the little people in our little mission project is actually nothing to us. What might seem like a huge building stone for us is just a sugar cube. Keep that in mind as we look at Isaiah 40. Isaiah paints a picture for us of our great God, who's much bigger than we are. And he didn't just make a fourth grade mission project. He's created the heavens and the earth. Isaiah 40, we pick it up in verse 12. Who hath measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, and meted or measured out heaven with the span, and comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure, and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Who's done that? It says, who hath measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? You know, that's just the scoops of water. You know, you stick your hand in a bucket and scoop out the water, right? The world's oceans, this is from my encyclopedia. The world's oceans combined contain 321,253,800 cubic miles of water. That's a lot of water. But when God created the earth, the idea that the picture that Isaiah is saying is, you know, God just a couple scoops for the Atlantic. Well, maybe do 4 or 5 scoops for the Pacific. You know, it's a big one, you know. Just measured out the oceans with the hollow of his hand. It says he has meted or measured the heaven with the span. The span, typically, is the measure from your thumb, when you stretch out your hand, from your thumb to the tip of your pinky. Some people say it's from the thumb to the tip of your middle finger, whichever is longest, I guess. For us, something like 9 inches. For us. We tend to use different measuring, different units of measure when we measure certain things, don't we? If I was to ask you how tall you are, well, we usually measure ourselves in feet and inches, right? Some of us half inches, you know, you've got to get everything in there, you know. Our children, you ask how old they are, you know, it's 5 and a half years old, you know. If I measure the distance on a trip, I'll measure it in miles. You know, how many miles did you travel last week? You know, and as you traveled around the country, buddy, you know, how far is this trip? If I'm measuring distances within the solar system, I might use another measurement. I might use the astronomical unit, which is the one astronomical unit. One AU is the distance from the Earth to the Sun. That's 93 million miles. It's from us to the sun. Now that's how distances might be measured in the solar system. And how many astronomical units out to Pluto and such. each one 93 million miles. When I start measuring things outside of our solar system, I probably will jump to light years. That's the distance that light travels in a vacuum in space in over 1 year. How far does light go in 1 year in a vacuum? Well, scientists tell us it's 5.88 trillion miles is 1 light year. Just one light year. 5.88 trillion miles. Does any of these numbers mean anything to you? Now you're thinking, oh my gosh, he's just giving us a science lesson. Oh my. I mean, think about this. I get panicky when my children ride their bikes to the end of the block. The moon, what, 250,000 miles away? I mean, we think of, you know, the Apollo spacecraft, you know, a couple of days out in space, but how many thousands of miles an hour are they traveling to get there? The sun, 93 million miles. The nearest star from us, Alpha Centauri, is 4.3 light years away. That's 4.3 times 5.88 trillion miles. Trillion, not millions, not billions, but trillions. That's just the nearest star. Our solar system is contained in what we would call a galaxy. The name of our galaxy is the Milky Way. The Milky Way is so huge that our little solar system, just one little speck in this, is 30,000 light years from the center of the galaxy. That's 30,000 times 5.88 trillion miles. That's just our galaxy. That's just from us to the center as we rotate around the center of the galaxy. 1995, the Hubble Space Telescope, I think this was after it got its new glasses, focused on a small section of space. They scanned a small section of space, 1/25th of 1 degree. That's all they did. Didn't do a full degree, heaven help us. Well, they only did 1/25th of 1 degree. And over the time that they scanned this 1/25th of 1 degree, they found 2,000 galaxies. 2,000 galaxies. A typical galaxy contains 50 to 100 billion stars. 2,000 galaxies in 1/25th of 1 degree. They estimate from that the universe contains 40 billion stars. Galaxies. Is anybody's like mind going, whoa, I'd rather look at my son down the block. You know, something I can comprehend. I don't know about you. These numbers are just way, way out there. I mean, you know, Dave, I don't know how much it costs you when you're, you know, jetting around the world in Taiwan. Now, how much it costs you to phone home? How much does it cost you to phone from Alpha Centauri? Is 4.3 times 5 trillion million. Boy, think of the phone bills. A light year, in fact, you know, our fastest thing that we can comprehend of speed-wise is light. And so even if you were to send a message on a light wave, on a light beam, whatever, from Alpha Centauri, it would take you 4.3 times 5, just a really long time. Really long time. It would take 4.3 years, right, just to get the message. Then you got to think of your answer and send it back. Take you 30,000 years to send a message to the center of the galaxy. Hubble Space Telescope has found star clusters 11 million light years from the Earth. They've spotted quasars that are 2 billion light years from Earth. The numbers just get bigger and bigger and bigger. The Bible says God measured the heavens with the span. Now, I don't think that means it just took a long time for him to count it all. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. No. It means God's got an awfully big hand. Our God is huge. I mean, sometimes I get lost in thinking of these things. You're thinking of... I mean, I can't keep track of what's going on in my household, let alone what's happening next door or every other house on the block, or let alone things that are happening within the entire city of Placentia where I live, or heaven help me to think of all the different things that are going on in Orange County, you know, let alone Southern California or the United States or the whole world, and that's one little planet circling one little sun among billions and billions of stars. God comprehends it all. You have a big God. It says he has comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure. I think that's like taking the coffee scoop and measuring, you know, getting your project, how many scoops you're going to do for this mountain over here and this hillside. I think that's the idea. That's the idea. Using something like that. Let me put it this way. How big are your problems? How big are your problems? I would dare say that some of you came in here this morning overwhelmed with the things going on in your life. Maybe you put on a good show, and maybe you can manage a few smiles as you get through church on Sunday. But for some of you, your problems are awfully big right now. I want to challenge you to think about how big your God is. Someone has defined circumstances as those nasty things you see when you get your eyes off of God. I mentioned this a few weeks back. It's a quote I think that's worth repeating. From Hudson Taylor, the great missionary of China, said this: many Christians estimate difficulty in the light of their own resources, and thus they attempt very little, and they always fail. All giants have been weak men who did great things for God because they reckoned on His power and His presence to be with them. See, the real question isn't how big are your problems. The real question is, how big is your God? How big is your God? My God has measured the heavens, the span of His hand. Says verse 13, who hath directed the Spirit of the Lord, or being His counselor, hath taught Him? This is a favorite verse of the Apostle Paul. He quotes it in Romans 11:34 and again in 1 Corinthians 2:16. You know, who hath directed the Spirit of the Lord? Who has been God? Who's told God what to do? Frankly, I think sometimes we have. I think sometimes we feel like we have to inform God about certain situations, and I think sometimes we are even big enough to offer Him some advice, especially when He's not doing it the way we think that He ought to be doing it. Have you ever had your five-year-old help you put together one of his toys at Christmas time? You know, Daddy, no, that piece doesn't go there, Daddy. I think the piece goes over here, Daddy. No, you got to do this like this, Daddy, you know, And you know, we're kind of patient, I hope, some of the times with our kids on this kind of stuff. But you know what you're thinking. You know, kid, you just get away, boy, you bother me. No. There's nothing wrong with pouring out your heart to the Lord and talking to Him about your problems. That's what He wants us to do. But be careful you don't fall into the trap of feeling like you're telling Him something new. He already knows all about it. And he already knows, Father knows best. That the program was right. Father knows best, just the wrong father. It wasn't Robert Young. It's our Father in heaven, knows best. He always knows the right thing to do. Sometimes the key to getting our prayers answered is in learning to ask for the things he wants us to do. The things he wants to do. Not because he's some spoiled child that needs to get his way, but because he wants us to come around to seeing things his way. And sometimes he's going to wait until we learn to see things from his perspective. Verse 14. With whom took he counsel, and who instructed him and taught him in the path of judgment, and taught him knowledge, and showed to him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket, and are counted as the small dust of the balance. Behold, he taketh up the isles as a very little thing. That's where we get that idea. It's just a drop in the bucket. It says, the nations to God. It's just a little drop in the bucket. Or as dust on the scales, small dust on the balance. In the old days, when you went into a marketplace to buy or sell something, the merchant would get out his set of scales, you know, and the thing with the arm that has, you know, the trays, and you balance the thing out, you know? And so you would measure things, a lot of things, you would measure by weight. And the merchant would put the weights on one side, and then he would put the basket there and fill the thing up until it balanced out. Well, a really honest merchant would, before he starts the whole transaction, would say, oh, just a second, let me blow off all the dust. I don't want you to pay for anything that you don't need, you know. Make sure that you get, you know, your full money's worth, you know. And it's like, what's a big deal, you know. To God, the nations, it's like dust on a scale. What's it to God? We get pretty impressed with the nations. I mean, there have been times, you know, for some of us growing up, you know, with during the Cold War years, you know, we feared Russia and all this kind of stuff, you know. To God, it's dust. He says, verse 16, and Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor the beasts thereof sufficient for a burnt offerings. All nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted to him less than nothing in vanity. Talks about Lebanon is not sufficient to burn. Lebanon was the country to the north of Israel and was famous for its forests. Forests of cedar trees. It'd be like saying, you know, if you cut down all of the redwoods in California and slaughtered all of the animals that are in the redwoods, even that wouldn't be enough of an offering that would really be worthy of God. Verse 18. To whom then will ye liken God? Or what likeness will ye compare to him? Now he's going to go into a thing where he wants to kind of compare what we look at, what we look for, where we get help from, versus God. He's going to compare God to the idols. Verse 19, the workman melteth a graven image, and a goldsmith spreadeth it over with gold, and casteth silver chains. He that is so impoverished that he hath no oblation chooseth a tree that will not rot. He seeketh unto him a cunning workman to prepare a graven image that shall not be moved. Now he's talking about the silliness of humans to make little idols. Now, maybe we don't have, you know, little Molechs sitting on our fireplace or anything nowadays. But they used to in ancient days. And if you were a really wealthy man, you would pay somebody and give him some gold, and he'd melt it down and he'd pour it into a mold and make you a little gold idol. This was your God. But it says even the poor guys who couldn't afford this kind of stuff, even they would take a good piece of wood and find a good wood carver with a good pen knife and make that little thing, you know, out of wood, and make sure it doesn't tip or toddle. I don't want my God falling over in the middle of the night, you know. I'm trusting in him, you know. That's stupid. It's silly, isn't it? We're beyond that. We don't do that kind of stuff anymore, do we? But see, our gods, our idols, are the things that we look to instead of God. Maybe we don't call him Molech or Baal or Ashtaroth or all these different silly little things. And maybe we don't have it all in a little compact form that sits up on our mantle. But without Jesus, we've all got our little gods. We've all got our little things that we look to. Verse 21, have you not known, have you not heard, hath it not been told you from the beginning, have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he that sitteth upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers, that stretcheth out the heavens as a curtain, and spreadeth them out as a tent to dwell in. Now, some of your science teachers in school will tell you that the Bible taught that the world was flat, and that's why people thought that the world was flat for so often, you know, in days of Columbus and stuff like that. Actually, the Bible says here that he sits on the circle of the earth, and you can translate the word circle. It could be correctly translated above. He sits above the globe. Some of the ancient translators, in their languages, translated it that way. There's a hint of the world being round here. The Bible doesn't teach that the world is flat. Men used to teach that the world was flat. Some of the ancient civilizations had incredible ideas about the earth. Some, what the Greeks taught, that the world was held up by Atlas, you know, the guy, that, Mr. Schwarzenegger. Others thought that elephants held it in place. You know, that would be handy if you ever need to move the earth. You just, okay. The Bible says, in Job 26:7, he stretcheth out the north over the empty place and hangeth the earth upon nothing. The Bible hits it right smack, right in the bullseye. The Bible has a correct view of the earth. Verse 23, he's that the one that bringeth the princes to nothing. He maketh the judges of the earth as vanity. Yea, they shall not be planted. Yea, they shall not be sown. Yea, their stock shall not take root in the earth. And he shall also blow upon them, and they shall wither, and the whirlwind shall take them away as stubble. He's talking about, you know, the great men of the earth that we think are so important, but all God has to do is blow on them, and they're gone. Verse 25, to whom then will ye liken me, or shall I be equal, saith the Holy One. Lift up your eyes on high, and behold, who hath created these things that bringeth out their host by number? He calleth them all by names, by the greatness of his might, for that he is strong in power, not one faileth. We think of the billions and billions and billions and billions of stars. We get dazzled. The Bible says that God calls them all by name. All these things he's made, he calls them all by name. Now, our scientists have given up naming things. You know, of course, I think you can have a star named after you now if you pay enough money. But, you know, we use numbers and stuff to name the stars. God knows their names. I have a hard time remembering more than like 50 names at a time. You know, I don't think I know half of your names, probably. I'd probably goof them all up. God knows all the names of the stars, billions in billions. In verse 26, where it says, for he that is strong in power, not one faileth. Another translation says, because of the multitude of strength and the power of might, not one is hindered from its order. All the stars follow their orbits. They all follow the established laws that God has set up. God holds everything together. And so he says, verse 25, to whom then will you liken me? Who are you going to look to bail you out of your problems? That's what this is all about. You know, the ancients had their little idols, their little things that would totter, and they'd pray to Molech or whatever, or pray to Baal to make rain, you know. God says, who are you really going to compare me to? I think we have escapes and we have advisors. The escapes, I think, are the little gods in our lives that promote fantasy and escapism. They are the things that we don't want, when we don't want to face our problems, we run to them. Drugs, sex, alcohol. Those are some of the escape things, aren't they? Those are the big bad ones, right? That we run to. You know, if it's just too tough, I need something to soften the edge. But there's other things that we run to. Living at the movies. I mean, man, it's, hey, I love going to Tatooine, you know? And get away from my problems here on planet Earth, you know? And it's fun to kind of get your mind, and that's okay. But when that's, you're running from your problems by running to the movies, it's like the little idol you set up on your mantelpiece. People who live in front of the TV set, you know, and their whole life is wrapped up in the next episode of As the World Turns. It's not hard to get caught up in these things. Sometimes we, our little gods are the things that we go to for advice. Sometimes we're kind of picky about who we'll go to for advice. If a person is mad at their spouse and they've just had it, they'll be very careful who they go to for advice. I've seen that over the years. I've seen people go to their friends who have all gotten divorces. Friends who they are guaranteed to tell them, dump the bum. And that's who they'll go to for advice. Who has been God's counselor? Nobody's been God's counselor. God has the answers. And He's got all the right ones. But we have all these different things that we'll run to because I don't want to hear what God says. There's a lot of different philosophies out there in the world that are begging for people to listen to them. But if you're thinking about entertaining some of these silly philosophies that are going around, let me just ask you this question to ask them. Who came up with their ideas? Well, this guy thought them up. Hey, this is it. Joe's infomercial, and this is his guide to success to life. What, this guy thought of these things? I mean, a guy who's just like that to God? Think about who you go to for advice. Is it somebody as incredible, awesome, heavy, powerful, as weighty as God? Or is it just some guy that thought something up? What's even scarier is that there's a lot of spiritual-sounding things out there. There's a lot of philosophies today that have a veneer of religion about them. Spirituality is really in right now. 20 years ago, it wasn't. You know, 20 years ago, it was like, you know, if you were a spiritually minded person, you know, you were like so backwards. I mean, you know, whoever thinks of that kind of stuff. Nowadays, everything has a spiritual twist to it, doesn't it? Everything has some kind of a spiritual overtone. In all the movies, there's always the Indian... The American Indian guy who offers, meditate and let the frog come upon you, you know, and you just think frogs, you know, or whatever. And they've got all these different, you know, things, you know, the wax on, wax off, you know, and we have all these different things. Spirituality is in. But what's scary is that a lot of the world's spirituality is stuff that comes from hell. Come from God. If you listen to the wrong advice, you're heading for a scary place. It is said, while there's life, there's hope. This seems to describe the case of six Navy pilots who left their aircraft carrier on a scouting mission during World War II, searching the seas for enemy submarines believed operating in the area. When they tried to return, they could not find their ship. It seemed that while they were gone, the captain had ordered a war-imposed blackout of all the lights on the ship. Over and over, the frantic pilots radioed, asking for just one light so that they could see to land. The pilots were then told of the blackout and that it could not be lifted, even for them. After several appeals and denials of their request, the ship's radio operator finally turned the switch to break radio contact. Rather than risk the lives of thousands on the ship, the pilots were forced to ditch in the cold Atlantic, and they died. The pilots left the ship thinking they would be able to return, but found that this was misplaced hope. So what are you putting your hope in? Does that come through? Does that message come through? It's scary to be trusting anything other than what God says in His Word. Very scary. Very, very scary. God says, who are you going to liken me to? Hey, hello. This is God speaking. Verse 27. Why sayest thou, O Jacob, and speakest, O Israel, my way is hid from the Lord, and my judgment is passed over from my God. Now he's talking to the Jews, who were the descendants of Jacob, or Israel. And he says, why are you saying, quote, my way is hid from the Lord, my judgment is passed over from my God? There is a problem. There is a danger that we can fall into when we have the big God thing correct. But for some of us, maybe we've thought about that. Maybe we've thought about how big God is. But there's a danger. And the danger is that you start feeling so very, very small, even smaller than small. And somehow God's lost you in all of this mess. I mean, it's kind of like me knowing and identifying every single living cell on my body. Oh, there's cell number Z2562A right there in the tip of my finger. It's a nice little cell. It's been there for about 2 days. No way. I can't see the cell. What about the atoms in the cell? Well, we lose track of that stuff real easy, don't we? Oh, shoot, lost a few cells here and there, but never even missed them, right? Have you ever thought about God being so big that maybe He's lost you? I think some of us have. I know I've felt that at times. I know I've wondered, did God somehow forget me? I still remember, and I'm the biggest dope when it comes to telephone things. I remember once I was talking to somebody and they put me on hold. I sat there on hold for 25 minutes. They forgot about me. I've often wondered at times, there's been times in my life where I felt like God put me on hold and then forgot that I was there. Do you ever feel that way? You know what? He hasn't forgotten you. God is so much bigger and smarter and wiser than us. He hasn't forgotten you. He knows the names of the stars, billions and billions and billions of stars. Well, that one's Fred, that one's Ethel, that one's... He knows the names of all of the stars. The Bible says He knows your name, John 10. He knows His sheep. He calls them by name and they hear Him. He knows He's got your number. He knows your address. He knows where you live. Though God is able to work on an incredibly big scale, He is also intimately aware of the smallest details of your life. Jesus said in Matthew 10:29, not even a sparrow worth only half a penny can fall to the ground without your Father knowing it, and the very hairs on your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You are more valuable to Him than a whole flock of sparrows. Gosh, I miss a few hairs all the time. You never miss them. And God's keeping track. That's amazing. Some of us, He has less to keep track of than others. I put you to sleep. You didn't even laugh at that one. Verse 28. Hast thou not known? Hast thou not heard that the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary? There is no searching of His understanding. He giveth power to the faint, and to them that have no might, He increaseth strength. You see, God doesn't faint. He doesn't quit. He doesn't say, oh, I can't handle this anymore. Never does that. Never does that. And not only does He not faint, but for those of us that want to quit, He gives us strength. Verse 30. Even the youths shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fail. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. For some of you, this will be just yesterday, but have you ever been around little ones at Christmas time? You know, the little guys, you know, 5 years old, 3 years old, you know, and running back and forth frantically all the time, you know. And I have heard many people exclaim, I wish I had a tenth of that kid's energy, right? I still think if somebody could figure out how to bottle the energy of these little guys, we could make a mint, you know, just to be able to get some of that. Don't you feel like that about 3 o'clock in the afternoon? You're just dragging and you want to take a nap and you tell them to take a nap and they're bouncing all over the bed, you know. But you know what? Even the little ones crash. Even the little ones crash. Though youths faint and young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They that wait upon the Lord. That's the key. They that wait upon the Lord. The word wait, it means to hope, to expect, to look eagerly for, to lie in wait for, to linger for. Sometimes when somebody special is coming over to the house, somebody the kids can just hardly wait for. And they're getting all excited. Sometimes what we'll do to calm them down is we'll put them on guard duty, you know, and they'll sit in our bedroom window peering out the blinds, you know, waiting, you know, or else they'll go out to the front parkway and they'll go looking up and down, waiting, you know, and then, you know, the person comes around the corner and they run in, you know, and charge in and tell us, they're here. That's what this is. Those that are waiting for the Lord. I'm not waiting for the paycheck to come in the mail. I'm not waiting for this situation to change. I'm not waiting for this person to change. I'm waiting for the Lord. I can hardly wait for God to do His thing. I can hardly wait to see what God's going to do. They that wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. The word renew carries the idea of exchange, to substitute, to change for the better, to alter. It's the idea of changing clothes. You know, you get off your work grubbies and you put on some clean clothes. You take off the weakness and you put on God's strength. Those that wait on the Lord shall renew their strength, put on fresh strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. They shall mount up with wings as eagles, ascend, climb with the wings of the eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. The wings like eagles, that part's cool. I like that. You know, flying is very, very cool. My dad used to have a pilot's license years ago. Love to go flying with my dad, kind of sometimes, except with the bumpy rides. But it's incredible to be, you know, 6,000 feet up in the air and all that you can see. It's absolutely incredible. Awesome. Very neat to go flying. But that isn't all that's mentioned here. There's actually three things that are mentioned here that can happen when we wait on the Lord. One of them is the eagle things. And yes, there are going to be times in our lives when God's going to pull off the eagle thing for you. And you're going to be thinking that you're hitting the pit and crashing on the rocks, and God comes and scoops you up. You know, that's how they say that a mother eagle will teach its eaglets how to fly. She pushes them out of the nest, you know, up there on the rocky cliffs of the cliff, you know, pushes the kid out, you know, and the kid's going, "Mom, Mom, this isn't fair. Where's Buzz Lightyear? You know, this isn't fair." And maybe the kid might pick it up, maybe not. And if not, the mom will come swooping down and pick the thing up. Pick up the kid. Mount up with wings as eagles. There's going to be times in your life as you wait on the Lord. That's what He'll do. He'll pull that off. And you'll sense Him catching you and taking you to the heights. Running and not growing weary, that's pretty cool. Now, that's not bad. I could get into that. Running and not growing weary. Not quite as glamorous as the wings thing, you know. But still pretty good. And then walk and not faint. Walk. That's pretty boring. Let's do the wings thing, God. You know, I'm pretty sad today. Could you do the wings thing? But you know, precious one, sometimes He wants to do the walk thing. William Carey, the father of modern missions, wrote, "I can plod. That is my only genius. I can persevere in any definite pursuit. To this I owe everything." Father of the modern mission movement, I can plod. I'm like kind of a boring guy. But he just does it, just keeps sticking, just keeps getting up every morning and putting one foot in front of the other. Waiting on the Lord will renew your strength. But it may sometimes just be for the walking. Day to day, getting up, putting one foot in front of the other. John Claypool, when he was the preacher of Crescent Hill Baptist Church, had a daughter who suffered from leukemia. When she went into remission, everybody thought that maybe God had healed her. On an Easter Sunday morning, she went into a terrible recurrence. In his book, Tracks of a Fellow Struggler, he relates how for 2 weeks his daughter was racked with pain, her eyes swollen shut. She asked him, "Daddy, did you talk to God about my leukemia?" He said, "Yes, dear, we've been praying for you." She asked, "Did you ask Him how long the leukemia would last? What did God say?" "What do you say to your daughter when you can't help her and the heavens are silent?" Emotionally and spiritually, he was exhausted. A few hours later, she died. The following Sunday morning, John Claypool got up and preached. He preached from Isaiah 40:31. He said something to this effect. There are three stages of life. Sometimes we mount up with wings as an eagle and fly. We're on top of the world. Sometimes we run and we don't grow weary. We just go through the routine. Sometimes it's all we can do to walk and not faint. And I need your prayers and your encouragement. At the moment that John Claypool was at his lowest, he preached probably his most influential sermon. Perhaps his greatest contribution came at his darkest hour. He could have said like Paul, "For when I am weak, then I am strong." They that wait upon the Lord. Who are you waiting for? Who are you waiting for? Don't stop waiting on God. Don't stop waiting anxiously to see what God's going to do. Those that wait on the Lord will renew their strength. They'll get fresh strength. Sometimes to soar, sometimes to run.